Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin sale bro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin sale bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Talk to him, Dr. Clark.
He called for the unity and the redemption of the African world.
Salute them, honorable Marcus
we
Garvey.
We were not ready to listen then.
They might not have been ready then.
There's wonder whether we are ready.
Ain't no doubt about it.
To listen.
We ready, baby.
Now.
Let's go. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Flag fly high. Woo! Flag. Whatever, Garvey would never die. On my 90, the throne ready, let's take a ride.
detonate in the elevator, holding the main charge. The green is for the cradle. Africa, everything first, the earth's navel. This excellency, put it together as a symbol of liberation. That's how we get the medals, RBG.
Anybody on the spot. I'm not intending to try and stir you up and make you do something that you wouldn't have done anyway. I pray that God will bless you in everything that you do. I pray that you will grow intellectually, so that you can understand the problems of the world and where you fit into in that world picture. And I pray that all the fear that has ever been in your heart will be taken out. And when you look at that man, if you know he's nothing but a coward, you won't fear him. If he wasn't a coward, he wouldn't gang up on you. He wouldn't need to sneak around here. How they function. They function in mobs. That's a coward. They put on a sheet so you won't know who they are. That's a coward. No. The time will come when that sheet will be ripped off. If the federal government doesn't take it off, we'll take it off.
The controlled press, the white press, inflames the white public against Negroes. The police are able to use it to paint the Negro community as a criminal element. The police are able to use the press to make the white public think that 90% or 99% of the Negroes in the Negro community are criminals. And once the white public is convinced that most of the Negro community is a criminal element, then this automatically paves the way for the police to move into the Negro community, exercising Gestapo tactics, stopping any black man who is on the sidewalk, whether he is guilty or whether he is innocent, whether he is well-dressed or whether he is poorly dressed, whether he is educated or whether he is dumb, whether he's a Christian or whether he's a Muslim. As long as he is black and a member of the Negro community, the white public thinks that the white policeman is justified in going in there and trampling on that man's civil rights and on that man's human rights. Once the police have convinced the white public that the so-called Negro community is a criminal element, they can go in and question, brutalize, murder, unarmed, innocent Negroes, and the white public is gullible enough to back them up. This makes the Negro community a police state. This makes the Negro neighborhood a police state. It's the most heavily patrolled. It has more police in it than any other neighborhood, yet it has more crime in it than any other neighborhood. How can you have more cops and more crime? Why? It shows you that the cops must be in cahoots with the criminals.
Yo, turn this motherfucking shit up.
Sit down.
Sit down.
Be humble.
Sit down.
Be humble. Me humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Who that thinking that he frontin' on that man? Get the off my stage. I'm the same man. Get the off my. That ain't right. I make a play blowing up your whole life. I'm so, so sick and tired of the Photoshop. Show me something natural like Afro on Richard Pryor. Show me something natural, I wanna feel some stretch marks. Then I take you down right on your mama's couch and polo black. Hey, this is way too crazy, hey, you do not amaze me, hey. I blew cool from AC, hey. Obama just paged me, hey. I don't fabricate it, hey. Most of y'all be faking, hey. I stay modest about it, hey. She elaborated, hey. This that great Poupon, that AV on that TED Talk, hey. Watch my soul speak, you let the med talk, ayy. If I kill an it won't be the alcohol, ayy. I'm the realest after all. Tell them be humble, holla, sit holla, down, holla, holla, be humble, holla, sit holla, down, sit down low, be humble, holla, tell them sit down, be humble, holla, sit down, holla, holla, be humble, holla, holla, sit down, holla, holla, be humble, holla, 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 be humble, holla, sit down. Sit down, be humble, sit down.
Rational fella, that's my bro, my family, bros in jail. When it comes to money, I did concentrate. Make I tell you straight, you are not my mate. If you be commission, I be head of state. But my people then go say, I know one buy, I know one die, I know one payment. I want enjoy, I want chop life, I want buy motor, I want build house, I still want turn up. Tell me, my nigga, what's it come? G-Wagon, all depends. Stick your step, ride the whip. Die for nothing, my nigga. What's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, the gadget, ride the whip. I know you die for nothing. Oh, no, I fall now. Yeah.
But we want to welcome you to our rally, our unity rally, for a united black front. To unite all factions of our people. To unite every one of the 20 million so-called Negroes into one group. And you'll notice, whenever the white man thinks that we're going to call a rally to knock our own kind, you see him jammed out here. He wants to hear us say something against King or against Bunch or against Farmer, against someone of our own kind. He jams out here. But when you call a rally for black people to unite, let's get together, you don't see too many white folks then. They don't like black people to get together in unity and harmony. As long as you and I are going to attack each other or talk about each other or heap scorn and ridicule upon each other, the white man gets his kick. But when he knows that we're going to come together in unity and harmony, he won't get his kick. He will get kicked. When you see you and I getting together, it is because we have begun to realize that we have a common enemy. And the only time we'll be able to come together with a common objective and a common goal is when we first develop a common motive. And that motive is best developed by recognizing the common enemy. And that common enemy is the white man. I say that common enemy is the white man. The white man is your enemy, whether you are a Baptist, whether you are a Methodist, whether you are an Episcopalian, or whether you are a Muslim, or whether you are a Mason, or whether you are an elk. If you find yourself running into opposition when you're looking for freedom, justice, and equality, or some kind of rights, you have to agree, always the one who opposes your right is the white man. Some old blue-eyed, blonde-haired, bad-smelling white man. When he puts his club upside your head, he doesn't care whether you're a Baptist, a Methodist, but he does want to know whether or not you're a Muslim. Because he knows if you're a Baptist or a Methodist, you're going to turn the other cheek. You're going to try and love your enemy. You're going to pray for them that despitefully use you. So he's not worried about you. But he knows if you're a Muslim, you're not going to turn the other cheek. If you pray for him, you pray that God kills him, or God helps you to kill him. That's the only kind of prayer you pray. It's time for you and me to unite, to get together, and get this big white ape off our back. You got a bad habit. You're hooked and don't know it. You got what's known as white disease. You think you can't get along without the white man. You think you can't get some clothes without the white man. You think you can't get a house without the white man. You think you can't even get a job without the white man. You're worse than a man who thinks he can't get along without heroin. You're worse than the man who thinks he can't get along without morphine. You're worse than the junkie. You're in worse shape than the junkie because the junkie only has a little monkey on his back and you're running around with a big white ape named Uncle Sam on your back. America is faced with her worst domestic crisis since the Civil War, or since the Revolutionary War. For America now faces a race war. A race war is worse than a Revolutionary War. A race war is worse than a Civil War. A race war is a war in which no holes are barred. A race war is a war in which children are destroyed, in which children are mutilated, in which children face the same destructive wrath that grown-ups face. A race war is the worst war that you can conceive. And this war, race war, that is coming upon the head of the white man is something that he is bringing down upon himself. The entire country is on the verge of erupting into racial violence and bloodshed. Simply because 20 million ex-slaves are demanding freedom, justice, and equality, here in America, from their former slave master, 20 million so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, seeking human dignity, seeking human rights, seeking the right to live in dignity as a human being. And rather than give genuine respect and recognition to your cry for human rights, The American white man answers your nonviolence with violence. He answers your prayers and your freedom songs with false promises, deceitful maneuvers, and outright bloodshed. According to what we are taught from the white man's textbooks and his school, the Revolutionary War and the Civil War were two wars fought on American soil, supposedly for freedom and democracy. But if these two wars were really for the freedom and human dignity of all men, why are 20 million of our people still confined here in America and enslaved by second-class citizenship? Something is wrong. The truth is that the Revolutionary War was fought on American soil to free the American white man from the English white man. The Revolutionary War was never fought to provide freedom and democracy in this white country for the black man. Our people remain slaves here in America even after the Declaration of Independence was signed. In fact, most of the white founding fathers who signed the Declaration of Independence were nothing but slave owners themselves. It is sheer hypocrisy, sheer ignorance, sheer insanity for our people here in America to celebrate the 4th of July as Independence Day, while white America still denies us first-class citizenship that goes with an independent people. And it is nothing but hypocrisy for the American white man to pretend that the Revolutionary War was truly a war of independence as long as 20 million black people here in America are denied the privileges of an independent people. Don't let the white man fool you. Don't let the white man smile at you and lull you to sleep. Behind that smile is a vicious heart. Behind those teeth is an animal-like beast who doesn't have it within him to want for you what he wants for himself and his own kind. Don't let that man fool you. When you look at that man, you're supposed to see him for exactly what he is. And if you want to know what he is, examine his deeds. Forget his words. He got a whole lot of pretty sounding words. Watch his deeds. His deeds are like the deeds of a snake, the deeds of a serpent, the deeds of a dragon, the deeds of a reptile, the deeds of a beast. Why, nothing but a race of beasts would take dogs and stick them on little black babies. Nothing but a race of beasts will stick dogs on black children and black women. Nothing but a race of beasts. And it is these deeds today that's causing the wrath of God to come down upon the head of the white man. And when you see him as he is and see how much hell he's catching, you're out of his mind to want to be with him. You're out of your mind to want to integrate with him. And you're really out of your mind if you take time to forgive him and ask God to have mercy on him. No, ask God to judge him. Ask God to do unto him as he has done unto you. He has caused your babies to suffer. Ask God to heap suffering upon his babies. He has caused your women to suffer. Ask God to heap suffering on his women. He has caused all of our people to suffer. You can't deny that. You may not like my saying it, but you can't deny it. Why, you got scars and knots on your head from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. And every one of those scars is evidence against the American white man and his inhumanity to man. The Civil War was also fought on this continent, not to free the black slaves, as is commonly taught in the white man's schools, but the Civil War was actually fought to preserve the Union, preserve this country, keep it intact for white people. It wasn't fought to set you free. It wasn't fought to give you some kind of emancipation. It wasn't fought to make you a citizen. It wasn't fought to give you civil rights. It wasn't fought because they respected you and loved you as a human being. It was fought out of greed. It was fought out of selfishness. It was fought to keep this country intact for their own white selves. In essence, this only means that the American white man fought the Revolutionary War to get this country for himself. And he then fought the Civil War.
those of you rolling around in the church and carrying on in the same position as well. But let me continue. This society is a society of criminals, run by criminals, and it is a creator of criminals. And we must recognize it. And that's, I have to say that because we got some people out here who say, I want my children to be just like them. That's the ultimate goal. I don't want there to be any differences. What are you talking about? You want them to be enslavers, rapists and robbers and killers and murderers and imperialists and so forth, just like the other folk, right? Think again, ladies and gentlemen. But due to our time, I'm just going to have to rush through here. I accuse the society of being a crimogenic society, a criminal society. A society that engages in white-on-black violence for a number of reasons. And of course, as you can tell often the psychology of an individual or people in terms of their origins and early childhood experiences, you can look at then the psychology of a people in terms of their origins and early childhood of their race. And when we look then at the origins of this society, we must immediately recognize that it is a society founded on criminal activities. Yes, and that is this inheritance today. It is still a part of it. A society that is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages on white, on black violence because it is founded on the murder and theft of Indian peoples and Indian lands. It is a crimogenic society, a criminal society, and a society that practices white on black violence because it is a society founded on the kidnapping of African people, the manslaughter of African people in the mid-passage, the extortion from African people of their labor, and the enslavement of African people. Therefore, the very nature and foundations of this society rest on two massive genocidal crimes, and this original crime is a part of its nature today. It is a crimogenic society because this group of people cannot face their own criminality. They must engage in the psychology of denial and repression and distortion. And this denial and distortion and repression must suffuse throughout the total society, throughout its total institutions, throughout its total values, and therefore ultimately it must pervert its total population. It is a criminal society and a white-on-black violent society because it engages in the crime of breach of contract. It has breached the contract of its constitution. It breached the contracts it made with African people during the reconstructions. It breached its contracts of the 14th, 15th, and other amendments. It breached its contracts in reversing its rulings in the 1860s, 1870s, 1980s, and 1990s. It breached its contract in terms of sharecropping, the peonage of our people, going back on the 40 acres and a mule, and all the rest of the things. It is a criminal society because it constantly engages in assault and battery against its black populations. It engaged in historical lynching, and behind the walls, as my brother mentioned here, of prisons, it still now engages in legal lynchings of African people. It engages in Klan terrorism, which it is still engaged in today. It engages in race riots where it destroys the African people. It engages in police riots, and it engages in police brutality where over 300 or more of our young men and women have been destroyed in the city of New York alone. It is a criminal society, and it is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages in white-on-black violence, because it is indicted on the charges of official malfeasance when it revokes its mandate in terms of giving justice to its people and makes this justice system an instrument of injustice, when its so-called rehabilitative system is a school for criminality. It engages in official malfeasance when it rigs its juries, when it legally lynches the ones it so woefully sentences. It engages in official malfeasance when it engages in gerrymandering of black districts, when it betrays the mandates of black voters, when it builds, as my brother mentioned here, prisons as industries, so that the incarceration of black men becomes a profit-making industry and a means by which the ruling class makes war against the subordinate classes. It engages in criminal activity, and it is a criminal society when it engages in unfair labor practices, job discrimination, when at the end of the Reconstruction there were more black skilled workers than there were whites, and the whites unionized to keep the blacks from taking advantage of the opportunities that were available to them. It is indicted for labor.
Thank you very much. Thank you kindly. Thank you. Thank you very much for your warm welcome. It's great to be back here with you again this evening. It's been a while, and I always appreciate coming and being with you, and of course appreciate your support. And I know each time I've been here, I've promised you about our next publication, but it's definitely on the way.
All right.
We are definitely now expecting to be out in November. And, of course, each time I talk with you, the book gets larger. At last count, Brother Sababu, my co-partner there, told me we were around about 800 pages. So we're going to try to split it up for you, maybe four and four. Give you some good wintertime reading. But then in a way, it's when we recognize that we are as complicated as any other people. And one of the things sometimes we underestimate the degree to which we must address ourselves as a people. And too often we have people who think that our issues and the things that we have to deal with can be described in 25 words or less. And that, and so there are people who think that we are small people and small-minded people, so they don't have to write sometimes some sizable material. If other nations and other people require libraries to deal with their issues, so do we. And the interesting thing about the upcoming book is that with that 800 pages, it's basically a survey.
Right.
Looking at various areas of life. If you recall, we titled it Blueprint for Black Power. And we are essentially then trying to lay out a blueprint, a prescriptive book. Now we are coming into more and more into prescriptive type of writing, laying out very practical kinds of steps and very practical methods for achieving what it is we must achieve as African people. This means we have to cover a lot of territory. We are covering psychology, we are covering, of course, history, sociology, a great deal of political science, a great deal of economics and related fields, anthropology and so forth, because all of these had to be combined in the process of nation building. And this is what we really have to be about, is the process of building a nation as a people. If you're not thinking in terms of nationhood, then I must say, frankly, you're not thinking seriously of being liberated. Trying to integrate and merge with our enemies is not going to solve our problem. And it's not going to happen, as a matter of fact. It is a fantasy that has kept us from taking care of business for far too long, the idea that we are going to one day be one with these people. That we're going to merge into invisibility with these white folks. And even if that were possible, we should question our motives for wanting to do so. No. Why would you want to merge with the world's greatest criminals and thieves? With the people who have the worst values the world has ever known. It amazes me sometimes how we can hear some of our parents telling our children we want to be just like them. Yeah, it's a joke. It's an insult to hear Dan Quayle or to hear President Clinton come and lecture black folk on values. How dare we let these people into our churches to try to lecture us on values? Mm-hmm. It's an amazing situation to try to talk to us about values. To try to talk to us about population control. Another joke. Yeah. Yeah. The first thing we think about when people talk about population control is the overproduction of African people. You know, so-called third world people. As I said, we can solve the overpopulation problem quickly if we could reduce the European population drastically. Mm-hmm. Yes, and people, of course, as I tell you, this world has to always be backwards, you see. The ones who need to be reduced most drastically have the world thinking the other way around. Because a good deal of the problem sometimes is not the number of people in the world, but the number of greedy people in the world. Where you have a so-called minority of people who consume the vast majority of the world's resources. This large population that they talk about could eat better if these people weren't eating everything up. And so to a good extent sometimes, to have more for everybody to eat, you have to get rid of the greedy ones. Ones who are over-consuming. Who are taking the food out of other people's mouths. You see? But here you have the people who rob you and take everything you got and then say, you don't have enough to support yourself. You know? And this is the kind of joke that we got going at here. We're going to come back to this issue of values. But we're going to talk a little bit about African-centered consciousness, personality, and culture as instruments of power. Because ultimately, this is what this whole struggle is about. Power. Not loving one another and all those things we hear. Power. And to a great extent, the problems that we are confronted with today as African people and African people in America flows from our powerlessness or our inappropriate use of power. Right. We've been made to even talk about it. We've been made to think that power is sinful, mm-hmm. and that to pursue it is a sinful pursuit.
All right. That's right.
And that it's wrong. But you cannot exist without power. Mm-hmm. Without power, there is no life. A battery without power is dead.
All right.
You need power to act, to behave in the world, mm-hmm. to deal with the world. And consequently, then, we must interpret what we are about in terms of power. And we have the power, ladies and gentlemen. We have the possibilities. We just need to reorganize ourselves, reorganize our consciousness and our personality and our culture, and see them as instruments of power and use them as instruments of power to transform our situation. So we should not look at consciousness as some abstraction. As I often tell people, the most practical thing you can have is a good theory, is a good concept to guide your behavior, to be used as an instrument to measure reality, as an instrument to test reality. A good theory then organizes the world and organizes one's approach to the world. It permits one to be able to evaluate the world in terms of where one wants to go and in terms of what one wants to do. To be without theory then is to approach the world on an ad hoc basis, you know, just to meet it here and there and to not approach it in a systematic form, to live reactionarily, always reacting to what other people are doing, always being overwhelmed by events and overwhelmed by the future instead of creating events and creating the future and making the future.
All right.
See, when one has then a good theory and a good concept, one is able to do that. Consciousness. Without human consciousness, there is no world. It is the presence of human consciousness that brings meaning into the world. Without human beings in this world, conscious human beings in this world, in effect, there would not be a world. We bring the world into being through our consciousness. And through our consciousness, we create the world we live in. Out of the totality of reality, our consciousness cuts out a world that befits itself. In other words, the kind of world you exist in reflects the kind of consciousness that you have. And notice, if you change your consciousness or change your values and orientation, you enter into a different world. You interact with different people. People often that you didn't even know existed in the world. Social situations that you might not have even recognized until you entered into a new level of consciousness. You see people, say, for instance, who become addicted, say, to crack or something, and now enter into a whole world and enter into a whole social system that before they became addicted, they hardly noticed. They didn't know what it was all about. And they picked up new friends and new relations, whole new ways of acting, whole new purposes in life. They lost old friends, broke with old families, and all kinds of things. In other words, the consciousness, that addictive consciousness, brought into the world a new foreground and put other things into the background. Therefore, man's consciousness is a creative act. And the kind of consciousness you have will determine the kind of world you create.
All right.
And consequently, when you look at the world that we live in, African people, we must recognize to a great extent it is a world of our own creation.
All right.
It is a world that has been generated by the type of consciousness we've been permitted to be instilled in us as a people. As I told you earlier today on the radio, we talk about the white man as having power. And I want you to recognize that power ultimately has to do with a relationship between people. and that the white man's so-called power is to a great extent based upon the nature of the relationship he has with the black man. We empower him by the nature of our own behavior and attitudes as a people. He cannot be, as I said earlier, what he is unless we are what we are. I'm telling you. To a good extent, the European is our creation.
All right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. If we look at our behavior, we will see that to a good extent it is our behavior, our values, our consciousness, the kind of personalities we've established in ourselves, our tastes, our desires and needs that maintains the European in this position.
All right.
We talk about the civil rights movement and the apartheid system of the South. When blacks decided just to get out of the buses and walk, the system changed.
Right.
Yeah. When they just stopped sitting behind the white driver, just changing that relationship changed the nature of power in that system. When they decided then to walk side by side, when they decided to walk abreast and line themselves up, because they had not walked that way before, for the ends before, the relationship changed. When they kept their monies in their pockets, when they sat on those stools and blocked the other people from them, and changed the nature of the interactions between themselves and Europeans, the nature of the system changed. So therefore, we have tremendous power. It depends upon how we align ourselves as a people and how we decide to relate to other people in the world, because they cannot have what they have unless we are who we are. And that is why we don't have to spend a great deal of time always appealing to them and analyzing them, because we can better appeal to our own sense of self and our own consciousness. And we waste a lot of time trying to transform them, when through transforming ourselves, they will be transformed automatically. The power is in our hands. We are not destined to be the servants of white folk. That is not the destiny of black folk. No way. And we have to change this idea, because many of us are still operating on that concept. As I said this morning, many of us go to these schools to become what? Qualified. To work for whom? For them. Why do we assume that they're going to have the jobs for us? Yes. These people are having difficulty making jobs for themselves. The greatest problems that the Europeans are facing today and the European economies are facing today is that they are not generating enough jobs for their own people. And even though America is bragging about the millions of jobs it's creating, those jobs are part-time jobs. The bulk of them are part-time jobs, low-wage jobs, and jobs that have little or no future. So when people talk about creating jobs, you got to ask what kind of jobs are being created. That is why, of course, the system is not investing in black education. It no longer needs black people to maintain its employment structure. You see it bringing in people from outside of the nation to be employed. You see it even is hiring in the world itself, in other nations and other places. Already it has reached the point where its need for black males is pretty much saturated. And it literally then is warehousing us in the jails and prisons and provoking us to kill each other and to destroy each other right here in these streets. And yet, we are still organizing the education of our children as if the white man still had jobs waiting for them in multitudes. How different our education would be if we sent our children to school to create jobs for themselves. To create their own economic and political systems, to see themselves as the major sources of their employment. As I remarked earlier today while we were in the radio station, I heard something about some people out here protesting for jobs and pushing these other people for jobs. And I asked the question, do we know how many jobs we really create for other people?
All right.
We are a job-creating people. We don't realize it because we don't think in terms of nation. You see, if we saw ourselves as a nation, we could see that we create jobs like any other nation.
All right.
I mentioned that today. How many jobs are created by black music?
All right.
Yeah. Look at the whole structure of the music industry. From promoters to manufacturers of the records and the tapes and what have you, to a whole entertainment field, to the sellers of music in the stores, you know what we say, the Tower Records and the other great sellers of records and music and so forth, advertising that uses our music and all these things. How many thousands of jobs are we creating as people? We're creating them, but they have them. You see? We sing the music, they sell it. We sing the music, they market it. We sing the music, they promote it, you see. We sing the music, they produce great conglomerates like Sony, CBS Music, creating all kinds of jobs. We're creating tremendous jobs for a lot of people. How many jobs do we create just buying from Koreans? Buying from other ethnic groups out here? How many people are we creating employment for in terms of our spending habits as a people and our consumption habits as a people? How many jobs are we creating going to jail? We're creating all kinds of jobs and wealth. And we must come to understand this. We are creating these jobs, and yet we are begging for jobs. This means then somewhere our consciousness has been impaired. We're begging for what we are making already. We cannot use our own creations as a source of our own wealth. I told you earlier today that the Creator could not have intended for us as African people to be a poor people if the Creator implanted in our soils all the wealth that was planted there.
Right.
We talk about the minerals and the oil and the gold and the this and the that that's implanted in African soil. So it seems as if the Creator blessed us from the very beginning with wealth and possibility. Therefore, for us to be going hungry over this wealth and to be starving in the midst of it and to be perceived as a dependent, indebted people while our wealth is being shipped out to other people. We're actually selling a lot of it for pennies and nickels and dimes and less. Means that there is something wrong with our consciousness. Because ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, we've said what? That the wealth of a people is ultimately not in their land. But where is it? In the mind.
All right.
The wealth of man is in his mind.
All right.
In his consciousness. You got to look at it. And we mentioned the example of Japan. No mineral wealth to speak of whatsoever. Nothing at all. A nation, by the way, which is totally dependent. Of course, we get things backwards, don't we? We see ourselves as depending on Europeans when the reality is the other way around, when they depend on us and our swords and our people. We have to be backwards in order for this situation to be the way it is. Our reality has to be turned backwards, and we have to live in an almost permanent state of deception in order to be used the way we are used. The Japanese must depend on others for their vital resources, their oil, their timber, all of these things that they use to create their technology and so forth is taken from the soils of other people and then sold back to them. And yet they are seen as rich and powerful. And the people whose wealth they take or buy are seen as poor and poverty-stricken. Ultimately, then, you cannot rob or take from wealth from a what? Poor people. You cannot get wealth from a poverty-stricken people. People who have nothing, you can get nothing from. So if you're getting all your diamonds and your gold and your magnesium and all this other stuff, then from African people, then African people must be what? Wealthy and rich. And therefore, if African people are poverty-stricken with this material wealth, then it must be because our consciousness as a people is impoverished. And we are suffering then an impoverishment of our mentality. As we said before, if you have a good mind, you can con another joker out of his land. You can con him out of his diamond and his gold. And this is what the other people have done. They have used their mind and their cleverness and taken from us what they did not have originally. And therefore, consciousness is not an abstract concept. It is not a theoretical concept. It is a concept that is directly related to the reality one lives in and to the reality that one experiences. It is directly related to the type of life that one will live and does live. So I'm going to look at this for a minute. Particularly the consciousness of Africans in America. I'm often somewhat amused and taken aback by the number of people in this society who claim that slavery occurred somewhere back there. That, and you got some so-called black conservatives who claim that slavery no longer influences the nature of African people. I wonder what those people have to conserve in the first place. Are they conserving power? They conserving wealth? What does a black conservative conserve? You know, you have to conserve something. And since they have very little, if anything, they must only be conserving the system that has created their poverty to begin with. And you see them ultimately justifying the poverty of African people and justifying the political and social and economic subordination of African people in the name of some kind of higher principles. So slavery is not supposed, the experience of slavery is not supposed to be operating in the mentality of black folk. And you hear a lot of our youngsters will say that as well. How do you talk about slavery? That was back there. Or you know, whites talk about it. Well, you know, that was back there. We don't have anything to do with that anymore. You see? And it's an amazing situation because you have to remind them that you're still living off the interest of the wealth that your forefathers earned from slavery. You are still enjoying the accumulated wealth that began with the enslavement of our people. And if you're going to enjoy the wealth that was generated by evil, then you must take the curse that comes along with it. And therefore, even though you personally had nothing to do with it, but because you have received stolen goods, you must pay the price as well. And because you fight and struggle to protect those stolen goods, and you defend them, and you organize your society and your relationship to white people to maintain them and to continue to enhance them, then you must pay the price. That's why you live in terror. That's why you're stabbed in these streets. That's why you're going to suffer, no matter how good you are. No matter how liberal you are. Mm-mm. Ladies and gentlemen, when we behave as adults, we must recognize that our behavior will be visited upon our children. And that our children pay for our misbehavior. As we say, an act does not end at the point of its occurrence. It continues to reverberate into the future and down across the generations. And that's why when you behave in a particular way, you have to think in terms of seven generations from your behavior as to how what you're going to do is going to affect those generations later on. And even though those children may appear to be so-called innocent, they will still pay the price of your own misbehavior. This country whose parents and whose adults have misspent its treasure, and while they have enjoyed that treasure, ultimately their children will have to pay the taxes and will have to pay the price. So we have a bunch of people out here who think they can rape and rob the world and think that they could have enslaved the world and think then that they are going to sleep well at night. It doesn't work that way. So we have some of our people here who think then that slavery was back then and had nothing to do, and had nothing to do with them. Ladies and gentlemen, we've never escaped slavery. We still share the slave consciousness of our great-great-grandparents. We are of the same mind to a great extent that they were. We have not advanced beyond these people. How can I say that? I generally ask a series of questions. You say that that slavery has nothing to do with you and slavery was back there. And I ask you the question then, what language do you speak? Mm-hmm. When did you learn that language? Was that the language African people were speaking when we were taken into slavery in America? In other words, the language we speak, at this moment is what? A slave language. The language that our slave ancestors were forced to learn. And we still speak it, and you can still hear the pidgin, the Creole, and the other kinds of stuff in our language right at this moment that they had to go through. That language, with its words defined by history and by an experience, is the language we use today to guide our behavior. It's the language we use today to talk to ourselves. It's the language we use today to learn about ourselves and to learn about the world. It's the language today we use to try to understand ourselves. Is there no wonder then that we are still confused? So we have not escaped slavery because we are still using a slave language, and we speak the language of slaves. What kind of food do you eat? You say soul food? Was that the food of African people? Slave food. The food that we find most satisfying. The food that we find that sticks to our ribs. The food that we call down home. A food that we learn to eat in the quarters. And yet we dare say that we have escaped slavery. That we have nothing to do with those people back there. That was back there. When our whole very social life and social relationships, our very definition of ourselves as a people, our very attempt to commune with ourselves is mediated by the food of slaves. Understand what I'm trying to get at? And how can you say that you exist in a different consciousness from another people? What kind of uniforms are we wearing? Huh? What kind of clothes are we wearing? Were these the clothes of African people? Huh? This is what we got to look at. Yes. What is this to say then that we've escaped slavery? What kind of names do we respond to? Yes. Yes. Tamikas and all these other things we got going out here. All right. What kind of names do we identify with? Why is it that African names sound strange to us now as a people, and yet we dare say that we have a different consciousness from our group? When people discuss the issues in L.A., they want to discuss them only within the context of the time that these disturbances occurred. And they only want to discuss them in terms of the images of people running around in the street and destroying property within that context. And one of the things that the ruling groups in this society always seeks to do is to control time. Control the use of time. And by confining then the discussion to the period of time of the disturbance, then the emphasis is on the actual behavior. And therefore the behavior is not placed within historical context, political and ideological context. And therefore is made to appear all the more irrational and purposeless. Often the events that precipitate a so-called riot or a so-called revolt appears to be somewhat minor, you see, and in and of itself not worthy of the kind of reaction that occurred. But this can only appear to be the case when one ignores the prior history of the disturbance and one ignores the underlying emotional state, social and political and economic conditions that existed at the time of the disturbance. When one forgets then that the apparently minor occasion which precipitated the reactionary disturbance itself may have been symbolic of a particular set of historical circumstances and symbolic of a particular state of mind. Merely the straw that breaks the camel's back. Because as we say in Black on Black Violence, every act has a history. And it's in that history that we come to understand it. And therefore, we must resist the attempts of those on TV who interview us and so forth to confine the discussion to the mere behavior of the people during the time that that behavior occurred. And we ourselves must look at the history that occurred prior to the event. And more importantly, at the state of mind of the people
who precipitated the event or were precipitated by events to engage in that behavior. The preconditions which set the stage, for the Los Angeles and urban revolts have a long history and are many. They include both socioeconomic conditions and the collective mental state of the African-American community. Of the two, the mental state of anxiety and frustration over current and future developments, that state is the more important. It's not the concrete state as much as the perception of the state and the state of mind of a people. The dissatisfied state of mind and the attitudes of black people toward our conditions constitute the major factors which precede and underlie urban violence and revolt. So you can't look at the number of people who have achieved middle class status and so forth. You must look at the state of mind of our people and the level of dissatisfactions that exist in our minds as people. The preconditions for the LA revolt, of course, were many. And I'll just name a few of them. We don't have time to go through them all. Some of you might have had a chance to see or read the Atlantic magazine of May 1991. And you see here, of course, the issue of race was its cover story. When the official subject is presidential politics, taxes, welfare, crime, rights, or values, the real subject is race. We have old quail who can't tell the difference between potato and potato talking about traditional values. Another coded word for race, implying that black folk have no values, implying somehow that black mothers and fathers actually tell their children to go out and commit crime. Son, when I want you to grow up, I want you to be the biggest crack dealer on the block. That would just make me so happy. Be a criminal. Drop out of school. You know, what is this man talking about? What is he implying when he tries to imply that there's an absence of so-called values in the black community? Be very suspicious, by the way, of these people who talk about values anyway. We have to ask him, what kind of values did they have to make them rob and steal and destroy the Indians and the enslavement of black people? As I often said about Jimmy Swaggart when he used to talk about that old-time religion. He used to march across that stage with that Bible pumping up and down. Yes, talking about the religion of his great-grandpas and how he wanted that religion brought back. Of course, I have to remind my people, you really don't want that religion brought back. Because at the time they had that religion, they were hanging and lynching black people and enslaving black people. So I definitely don't want that old-time religion. And I'm a little weary about those traditional values he's talking about, too. Because those are apparently the values that underlie the racism of this nation and that rationalizes white supremacy. And that somehow lays the ideological foundations for the mistreatment of African people in America. I am not concerned then about the restoration of their so-called traditional values, but the creation of new values. In this book and in this magazine by Thomas Byrne Edsall and Mary Edsall, they start out the article by stating, race is no longer a straightforward, morally
unambiguous force in American politics. Instead, considerations of race are now deeply embedded in the strategy and tactics of politics. In competing concepts of the function and responsibility of government, and in every voter's conceptual structure of moral and partisan identity. We're at the very center and heart of how America defines itself. Race helps define the liberal and conservative ideologies, shapes the presidential coalitions of the Democratic and Republican parties, provides a harsh new dimension to concern over taxes and crime, drives a wedge through alliances of the working classes and the poor, and gives both momentum and vitality to the drive to establish a national majority inclined by income and demography to support policies benefiting the affluent and upper middle class. In terms of policy, race has played a critical role in the creation of a political system that has tolerated, if not supported, the growth of the disparity between rich and poor over the past 15 years. Race-coded images and language changed the course of the 1980, 1984, and 1988 presidential elections, and the 1990 elections for the governorships of California and Alabama, the U.S. Senate in North Carolina, and the post of Texas Secretary of Agriculture. The political role of race is subtle and complex, requiring listening to those whose views are deeply repellent to some and deeply resonant for others. The debate over racial policy has been skewed and distorted by a profound failure to listen. And so we see here then that blacks are the scapegoats of this society. African Americans are the means by which this society defines itself. As I say it again in black violence, you see, that the whole of the white ego and the whole of the white self-image is built on its definition of who black people and African people are. That is why it is obsessed by criminalizing African people. Whenever you see a people insisting against all kinds of evidence on negating and scandalizing the personality of another person or another people, you recognize then that they're engaged in those acts to protect their own ego, and that their ego structure is built on maintaining the scandalizing of their targets. And that if they did not have these targets of scandal, if they did not have these egos, these people as scapegoats, their facade and their infrastructure would crumble and fall apart. They would come face to face with the madness and insanity that motivates their personalities and their systems. When blacks move out of our role as scapegoats and redefine ourselves in ways that cannot be denied by any people in the world, then white people will go crazy. And they will fall apart. And we said in Black on Black then that the so-called criminality of black people is an economic and political necessity for maintaining the system. It is not merely an accusation flowing from racial prejudice, nor merely accusation flowing from racial hatred, as hatred has little to do with it. It is necessary to the very foundations of the system itself. That's why at the center of it, even in the current politics of the day, you will see African people. And how will you deal with African people has a determining factor in terms of who will get elected and who will be given power in this society. It determines who will be called liberal and who will be called conservative. It determines then the support that they will win in this system or will not win. And we have a situation here then where the Democratic Party and the dastardly behavior of Clinton is trying to change the perception that the white electorate has of it so that it can gain power by disrespecting black people and by creating bogus issues. And again, it has come to recognize, as is made very clear in this article, which basically lays out a program for the Democratic Party for achieving power in America by saying, you got to learn somehow to disentangle yourself from these black folk. Because in an analysis that you sponsored, a polling firm that you hired found the following. These white Democratic defectors, talking about those, what you call the Reagan Democrats, expressed a profound distaste for blacks, a sentiment that pervades almost everything they think about government and politics. Blacks constitute the explanation for their, white defectors, vulnerability and for almost everything that has gone wrong in their lives. Not being black is what constitutes being middle class. Not living with blacks is what makes a neighborhood a decent place to live. These sentiments have important implications for Democrats, as virtually all progressive symbols and themes have been redefined in racial and pejorative terms. The special status of blacks is perceived by almost all of these individuals as a serious obstacle to their personal advancement. Indeed, discrimination against whites has become a well-assimilated and ready explanation for their status, vulnerability, and failures. So you see why we got to look at more than whether we've gotten an increase in jobs and whether more of us are in schools and so forth, because the attitudes that the other people are operating on have little or nothing to do with these sort of things. You read last week where the whites engaging in the buying of weapons is increasing at a faster rate than blacks. And whites engaging in violence is increasing 30% faster than blacks. And as I will talk a bit later on, this speaks to the fact that whites feel extremely vulnerable. They feel under threat. And this implies then that at some point these feelings may boil over into attacks on the black community. For the rationales have already been set. This situation where the election to political office, where gaining the reins of power depends upon one's relationship and attitudes toward blacks, is very serious. It means then that blacks must be subjected to a constant barrage of innuendo and scandal. And that the best way to get over then is by attacking the very integrity and humanity of the black community. And it means then that this attack on the humanity and the integrity of the black community must proceed even at the time when some blacks appear to be making it up in the system. It means that you must even use those blacks who are making it up in the system to join you in the attack on themselves This is one of the underlying causes. This is one of the preconditions that was there when the LA insurrection occurred. If you read the current Atlantic magazine, which seems to revel in the analysis of African people, they will talk in this current month about the suburban century. They call it the suburban century begins. What do they mean by that? They're referring to the fact now that the political base of this country lies in the suburban areas. And for the first time in the history of this country, it's the suburbs who carry the weight in terms of votes. It is no longer the large cities which carry the larger percentage of voters. And consequently then, politicians who expect to get elected to office must speak to the suburbs and must cajole those and flatter those who live there. This is why then you're hearing again and again about this neglected middle class, you see, and programs that concern themselves with rehabilitating and restoring the middle class. Another code for we are going to ignore these blacks whom we have locked into these inner cities. And we are not now going to propose any kind of programs for them. We are now going to propose that you are the ones that are in trouble. And we now are going to rescue you from your troubles. You look in many of the publications today talking about edge cities. New cities created principally by whites that ring the inner cities. Cities that now whose governments are almost under direct control of these white suburbanites. Cities then that have influence in state governments in such a way that they can prevent taxation schemes that are meant to rescue the inner cities, that are meant to change the direction of the miseducation of our children, that are meant to relieve the problems of the inner cities. We have a situation then where whites have organized themselves in such a way that a politician who even talks about the rescue of the cities is literally damned for state office or for higher office. And now you see Clinton and other groups speaking to this suburban fringe. Is this fringe suffering? They tend to think that the black community implicitly or explicitly is not aware of what is going on. Let's look at some of these things, some of these preconditions. By 1991, the federal government's largest housing subsidy program was providing an average of $3,000 a year for each of 6 million wealthiest households in America, while offering nothing to the 36 million Americans in poverty. Only one of every 8 federal benefit dollars actually reaches Americans in poverty. There has been a wholesale rape and robbery of the poor and weak in this country. And yet, this is the class that is supposedly now being rescued and is now supposedly being ministered unto by those who run for office. From 1980 to 1991, in constant dollars, the average federal benefit received by households with incomes under $10,000 declined by 7%. An actual decrease in benefits from the government, but yet we get a lying and deceptive image that because of the fiscal difficulties in this country are those people on welfare, of the burden placed upon the government and upon the treasury by the poor people and by inner city people. And yet these people earning under $10,000 have actually had their monies taken away and not added on to, while the rich and while the middle class have actually fed at the government troughs. On average, households with incomes under $10,000 collected a total of $5,690 in benefits. On average, households with incomes over $100,000 collected $9,280 from the government. In other words, those making over $100,000 collect nearly twice as much from the government as those earning under $10,000. You see, you hear whites in making these discussions and talking about the state of this country and talking about the debt that this country is suffering from. And you can hear them talk about the deficit and the threat that this deficit holds for the health of this nation. And I want to warn you that this nation is in a very precarious state of circumstances. And the precariousness of its state will be made clear after the elections. But if you listen carefully, you can already feel the panic over the concerns of the economic state of this country. They are in such a panic that they know they have to reduce the deficit of this nation if it is to survive and if it is going to be socially viable. In my series on power, I talk about one of the causes of black-on-black violence, other than the psychology that I referred to earlier, other than the social relations, has to do with the economic state of the black community. I try to emphasize that it's very important from a conceptual point of view to think in terms of a nation within a nation when it comes to analyzing black problems. I am not advocating that you buy the concept that we should have a nation within a nation. So don't give me a knee-jerk reaction right on. What I am saying is just think conceptually in terms of black people as a nation within a nation. I think when you use this concept, it will help you to see some things that perhaps you cannot see through the use of other concepts, such as individualism and the other stuff that people lay on you. When you look at the black community and the African-American community in this country as a nation within a nation, it becomes almost immediately apparent as to why there's so much violence and social disorganization in the black community. I often use the Chinese Opium Wars to illustrate what I'm talking about, of how the British, in entering trade with the Chinese, were buying all of their tea from China, and China was buying nothing from the British. The British had nothing the Chinese wanted. And yet the British wanted that tea. They were hooked on a tea habit. And the Chinese demanded only silver and gold from the British. And that meant over time that the British balance of payments became unbalanced because her silver and gold was flowing into China, but no earnings were coming back from the Chinese. And they were facing a dilemma. They recognized that this situation could not continue, or else they could not maintain their social institutions, and they could not maintain social order in their society, and that their government could not maintain legitimacy, and the people at some point would rise up against it in revolt and refuse to follow its dictates and refuse to pledge allegiance to it and destroy it. Because this is what happens to nations when they have negative flows of wealth. Because it takes wealth to maintain order. It takes wealth to maintain institutions. It takes wealth to maintain employment system. It takes wealth to create jobs. It takes wealth to educate children and so forth. And when that wealth is flowing out into the hands of other people, these institutions collapse. the discipline of the people collapse. The obedience and the habits of obedience collapse, and chaos begins to reign. And the only way governments can maintain power then under those circumstances is often to use martial law and strong martial means of maintaining population control. And that has serious limitations. And the British then recognized that we had to change the situation or else our very society will be destroyed. And what did they do then? They hooked the Chinese into an opium habit and started and addicted the Chinese and then demanded of the Chinese, once they got hooked, now you pay us for your opium in silver and gold. And that habit got to such a level that the balance was reversed and the flow went out of China to England. And when the Chinese tried to stop it, the English government, the old pusher that it is, yes, a government based on drugs. The Queen, the greatest drug pusher the world has ever known, went in like any gangster on these streets out here to protect their monopoly to sell drugs to the Chinese and engaged in two wars to maintain the drug market that they had established. And yet you try to sit here and listen to these jokers with their moral pieties try to talk to us. Nation built upon the selling of drugs and the government coming in defense of the selling of drugs. But my point here is, of course, what happens when you get trade imbalances. And the Chinese recognize if we don't stop this stuff, our wealth is going to flow out to such a degree until we then will suffer social collapse. Now, when you look then at the African-American communities surrounded by non-African communities, plagued by economic parasites, coming into its midst and taking its wealth and earnings right out, exploited by white and non-white alike, who rob it of its wealth and rob it of its resources, and who even in his stupidity tries to say the answer to this is to increase the number of us with skills and education, only to have those with increased skills and education also what? Shipped out so that they can solve other people's problems and spend their earnings in other people's markets, and therefore can't return neither their skills nor their wealth back to the original community. So then what do you have? A community, an African nation with a tremendous trade deficit, with a tremendous trade imbalance, with a tremendous outflow of material resources and capital and brain, and an increasing concentration then of people who are bereft of skills and resources and the like. Violence and social disorganization, family and institutional disorganization becomes inevitable under those circumstances. Am I getting across to you? Because I don't want to hear you talking to me when I tell you that you've got to throw these Koreans out of this community, and you've got to throw these Arabs out of this community, and you've got to throw all the rest of these jokers out of this community, come talk to me about some racial harmony and love and reverse racism and hiding under Islam and some Christian ideology. Because you must recognize the hard, cold fact is you cannot educate your children. You cannot train them in the way they should go. You cannot give them appropriate recreational centers and other things they need without material wealth. And you can't do it by handing it over to other people. And it is not the result of hard feelings or racial hatred against any other people. It is not reverse racism. It is a matter of survival and protecting your own. I do not want to hear any pompous discussions about values. A pompous discussion about how parents should teach their children values. Anybody who's lived in the ghettos as long as I have knows that you can teach values day in and day out and still lose your children. Because we live in a world and in a context where we are not the only one that raise our children. We're not the only ones that influence our children. The middle class isn't better at raising children, and it isn't better at projecting values. It is only better at buying neighborhoods. Because when you buy your house, you buy your neighborhood. You buy your school. You buy a set of neighbors. And you buy a social and political context. That is not just the buying of a house. You buy a totality. And you buy a totality that supports your values. Values are little or no account when they are not reinforced by a social system and rewarded by concrete outcomes. How long can one hold on to a value when one is starved with holding on to that value? When one is punished and rejected, even when one demonstrates that one has held on to that value. When then we demand that our children exhibit certain values, then we should be in the position to reward their exhibition of those values. Or else we will look as hypocrites and fools, and we will give them empty and pious sayings that in the long run works against their interests and not for their interests. Half, or at least 400 billion, of all entitlements went to households with incomes over $30,000. Do you hear what I'm saying? $400 billion went to people who earned over $30,000. Talk about your individual pride and your individual drive and how you got your little house as a result of individual drive, even though you ran down to the Federal Housing Authority to back your mortgage and to back your down payments. Even though you have engaged the federal government to insure your mortgages. And you're going to talk about how independent you were in getting your house. How can the poor then go to the federal government and get it to insure their rent and pay out rent and other costs? Now, you got a government behind you even when you think you're buying that house all by yourself. Even when you think you've scraped and saved and put that down payment on it. When you sit up there and deduct those credits, who do you think stands in and pays the tax? You don't pay. When you write so proudly the deductions that you deserve as a homeowner. When those of us who pay rent and other things cannot make the same claims. Do you think that you are being independent? No, you are not. You are feeding from the federal trough. And you are feeding at the rate of billions from the federal trough. And therefore, those, one half of all of those entitlements, $400 billion, went to households, 30,000 and above. One quarter, or at least $200 billion, approaching almost the whole earning power of black people, went to households with incomes over $50,000. Who is on welfare? Who is dependent? Understand? That's why when you hear them on TV talking about this federal deficit, they'll just mention the word entitlement. Well, we've got to get rid of these entitlement programs. And of course, people read into them, oh, they're talking about those welfare people. You see, they're talking about those Section 8 folk or something like that. And you ask yourself, why do they never discuss what they mean by entitlement? And why is it that despite the tremendous deficit that this country is facing, a deficit that threatens its very viability, those men in the U.S. Senate and House cannot pass bills to straighten that deficit up? They are so gutless and afraid to pass bills and come to terms with a deficit that is threatening the very social foundations of this nation, that they are trying to create a constitutional amendment so that they would be forced to balance the budget against their will, because they know that they can never develop the will to do it. That's the way New York State does it. You know, it's just written in the Constitution. You've got to balance it, period. There's no way around it. The federal government doesn't have this, you see. And so now what the Senate is saying, those people in the Senate are saying, we can't get the guts, despite the threat, to see that this doggone deficit is taken care of. Why can't they get the guts? Is it that they're afraid of welfare people? Are they afraid of welfare rights? Mm-mm. They're afraid of the main welfare people, those suburbanites that they're talking about, those $50,000 a year people, those $100,000 a year people who are now getting billions of dollars from the federal trust. That's why they can't pass it, because those are the people with the lobbies. Those are the people who with the organizations. Those are the people with the power. Those are the people who can diselect folk. And so consequently then, they are almost ready to see this country collapse on itself. But you know in the end who's going to be blamed for it, because they keep just using the word entitlement. And the mass population will read entitlement as people on welfare. We're going to have then an attack, a genocidal attack on black folks. What are the long-term preconditions then that set up the L.A. riot besides the ones I mentioned? An interesting piece in the Village Voice called Herbicide by Daniel Lazar points some of them out. Subsidized private housing. You must know, you see, that the government, you notice whenever the government tries to read what they call leading economic indicators as to whether the economy is moving up or whether the recovery is over, what is the first thing they look at? Housing. Housing and housing starts. Because if you stop for a minute, you recognize the building of houses is attached to so many other industries. You understand? When you buy a house, you're buying furniture, you're buying rugs, you're buying carpenters, plumbers, you're feeding the brick industry, you're feeding the pipe industry, you're feeding the tile-making industry, the insurance people, there are tons of people that ride on housing. And that's why the government looks at it as a crucial factor in indicating recovery or not. And consequently, the government is not going to take a hands-off approach to housing and to the buying and purchasing of housing and the building of housing. No, by no means. Because the housing and the building of housing is crucial to the economic system. So consequently, it will create perks and other kinds of things to try to generate the increased development of housing and building of housing and buying of housing. And therefore, even though the middle class may deceive itself into thinking it's due to its hard work and its values that it gets these houses are subsidized. By the U.S. taxpayer, by the poor, and by all the citizens in this country. But you see, again, the rich call their welfare subsidies, tax credits, and all these other names, and they call ours welfare. Each year, the federal government doles out an estimated $70 billion or more in annual tax subsidies to bolster an ostensibly private suburban home market. By comparison, the federal government allocated just $1.8 billion last year for public housing and $150 million for subsidizing programs for the homeless. $150 million compared to what? To billions. $70 billion subsidizing suburban housing. $150 million for the homeless. $1.8 billion for public housing. The racist backlash engendered by the black migration wave of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s vastly accelerated a process already underway, that is urban decline, to whites were getting out. And that's what has happened. Whites have just left the cities, mainly to get away from blacks. But this was not done innocently. This was assisted by the government itself. This was assisted by a government that took your savings in these banks, the savings that they denied to you, called redlining, a government that, a situation that we saw last week, that the higher the earnings of black people, the greater the rejection rate for our loans, okay? A system that takes the billions of dollars earned by black folk, and I haven't even talked about created by black folk. What do we say? If Tyson earns $20 million, he must be generating what? $200 million. Where's the other $180 million going? Why aren't black people getting that? If Michael Jackson earns so many millions of dollars, then he must be creating what? A billion. Where's the other part of the billion going? Why aren't black people getting this other part? If we earn over $300 billions of dollars, then we must be generating well over $1 trillion or more dollars. Where is that money going? And how is that money used? In what banks is it being deposited? But we won't look at that. Let's look at what we put in and recognize that the very money we put into these banks across this country are the very monies that were loaned out to pave the roads to suburbia. The very monies that were loaned out to move factories out of this nation and to other segments of this population so that these companies would not have to deal with unionized labor and so forth. In other words, the oppressed, to a great extent, finance their own oppression. Drugs, we don't have to talk about. Deindustrialization, America has been on a retreat from manufacturing since the 1970s with devastating consequences. Between 1958 and 1975, New York City lost nearly 50% of its manufacturing job base. And then you want to compare black children and black people with the other generations. When the other generation, when they dropped out of school in the eighth grade or the sixth grade, could walk into a plant, could walk into some kind of industry and get a decent paying job. And now that net has been swept completely out from under black people. Nearly 50% of manufacturing jobs went out between 58 and 75. Under the Koch administration, they lost an additional 37%. The thing about this deindustrialization is that it is deliberate. It was not accidental. It was deliberately and consciously planned. You had a bunch of foolish people who thought that all this country needed to do was to sell information and to process information, to ship its factories out to other places and work with information only. And thought that Wall Street and that gambling joint down there would be the basis for maintaining the economy of New York City. Foolishness. Pure foolishness. A nation that literally does not tax industries and so forth owned by its own citizens once they move off the border of America. That literally then encourages and subsidizes the actual movement of industry out of the country. And in turn, has a very liberal tax policy for foreign countries that own businesses in America. And that's why the Japanese call them children. Yeah, boys, foolish, white males, I see by them is it's just a bunch of foolish little boys. These people will be eaten alive by the Asians because they're so caught up in their racism and arrogance, they cannot see what is going on. We'll sum it up here then by saying then that there were many preconditions prior to the LA disturbances and other disturbances. And these were the history of the act that we saw occur there. On top, though, of these conditions, is what I call the state of mind. You know, whites, as I've indicated, think that they are nonviolent people. They will measure their levels of physical violence with black levels of physical violence. And as I said, they run a statistical game. And they'll often get away with it because people associate violence with physical interaction. You see, so we talk about violence and automatically we think of murder, killing, you know, physical attacks and assault and so forth. But you see, when you're in power, there's another form of violence available to you. And when you're in power, you can call it by other names because power gives you the right also to define. And the power to define manipulates people's consciousness and blinds them to reality. And therefore, the ruling classes can appear to be even effeminate, nonviolent types, wouldn't hurt a fly, but are yet the most violent people.